Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hey, it's Anna. And this week we are sharing something different. To continue the conversation we've been having with you about estrangement, I joined a live national call-in with our WNYC colleagues at the show Notes from America. Host Kai Wright and I heard from listeners from all over the country about how stark disagreements, particularly around politics and key values, have led to estrangement with your families, longtime friends, and also in your longtime romantic relationships. Once again, what you listeners shared with us was more honest, layered, and more unresolvable than I typically hear on radio talk shows. So thank you, as always, for joining in our conversation. I hope you enjoy this one.
Estrangement feels like I've lost a limb and I'm learning how to live without it.
I have been estranged from my family since I was 16. I moved out and I just never saw them again.
I responded and told him, well, the hubris that it takes to tell somebody how they should think has to be pretty high. And that sort of, it blew it up pretty badly.
I had been reaching out and trying to contact her, and she just wanted to tell me that she just wanted me to stop trying to contact her.
Because the estrangement is kind of this thing that there's no like public rituals for it. Like people might see me and I'm like high functioning, and yet I carry all that grief with me.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome to the show. And this week, we're trying something new. Those voices you just heard, those are listeners of one of my favorite shows, Death, Sex, and Money. And their host, Anna Sale, is with me this week to invite all of us into an interesting conversation she's been having with her listeners over the past few months. Hey, Anna.
Hi, Kai. Yeah, we just put out this series about estrangement on the podcast in December. And in the course of making it, we heard from hundreds and hundreds of listeners about the pain, isolation, and really the lack of public vocabulary about estrangement. Mm-hmm. And estrangement, in our meaning, is an experience of feeling cut off from a relationship or a community that once felt like home. We heard from people who left relationships that felt they were no longer safe or were serving them, and people who were cut off and didn't always understand why. And Kai, one thing that really came through in our series about our listeners' experiences with estrangement of all kinds was that it's not necessarily a good or bad thing. Mm. It can be necessary and empowering. It can also be devastating and confounding, and it can be all of that at once. And the reason I'm really interested to talk with you and the Notes from America listeners about this is I think one of the primary themes of this show is about estrangement writ large, like from each other and from the systems of American democracy. Like every week you are asking yourselves, what values do we share and what are our non-negotiables? And when there are deal breakers, what then? What can you work with and when do you draw a line and give up? And I think that's something a lot of us in America have thought about, both in our relationships to institutions and systems and also in our closest relationships where differences of values have flared.
Yeah, and that is the work here. And sadly, even right now as we speak, there are many places we can look and see the social fabric of this country torn in horrifying ways and where there are real questions about whether differences can or even should be reconciled, you know. And this would have been the 50th anniversary of the right to an abortion nationally. People marched in cities all over the country to protest new anti-abortion laws today that to some seemed unthinkable not too long ago. Meanwhile, also today in Monterey Park, California, residents are grieving a mass shooting that happened at a ballroom dance venue last night on the eve of Lunar New Year. There have been 33 mass shootings this year in 2023 already, according to the Gun Violence Archive. But anyway, Monterey Park is famously a majority Asian American community. It's said to be the first in the country. Law enforcement officials have not publicly declared a motive for the violence or said that it, you know, has anything to do with the holiday. They've only said that the lead suspect is an Asian male. But I'm not sure any of that matters when I think about just the real fear and ostracization and estrangement that so many Asian Americans have expressed over the past few years. People saying they just no longer feel safe or at home in places where they once felt at home. So these kinds of things are the unavoidable backdrop to all of our lives and our relationships and our effort at social cohesion. And so they are also the backdrop to the conversation we are going to have right now. And listeners, we really intend for this whole show to be driven by you and your experiences. So here is what Anna and I want to hear from you. Are you wrestling with a relationship that is really important to you, but in which there is now such a profound challenge to your values that you're not sure it's worth it anymore? And this might be an estrangement that's because of who you are, something about your personal identity. Or it could be because of something you or someone else believes, like a particular set of ideas about faith or politics or health. Or it might be something altogether different. Who knows? And as we take your calls, we're joined by Rebecca Martinez Fitzgerald. She's a therapist based in Durham, North Carolina, who specializes in estrangement. She's been leading a group for adults who have decided they need to pull back from their relationships with their parents. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you specialize in adult children who are estranged from their parents, and we will talk to you about that specific dynamic of estrangement of parental relationships. But I know you've thought about this topic on many levels. So just what about this broader conversation that we've set up here? Is there any evidence that estrangement is somehow a more common or more acute thing today than it has been in the past in the U.S.?
Maybe. I'm finding in the zeitgeist, there seems to be a lot of commentary specifically from, you know, parents who've been cut off, you know, by their adult children, that this came out of nowhere. They didn't expect it. And there's a lot of stigma around estrangement. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're hearing more about it, but I think that it's always existed. Especially when you consider a broader definition of estrangement encompassing not only cutoff, but just the strained nature of a relationship and deciding to reduce contact, reduce exposure, reduce the amount of time or attention is spent between folks. I do think people are discussing mental health and boundaries and generational trauma more consistently these days. And there may be more people who are making personal boundaries more explicit with between themselves and others. But, you know, relational strain has existed as long as people have, I'm quite confident. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of data to determine it either way.
Rebecca, do you think that the support systems for people experiencing estrangement, while it may have been maybe a timeless phenomenon, as you say, do you think that our support systems and just way of being able to talk about this phenomenon is improving?
Maybe improving in the fact that any of it exists. I mean, there are Reddits, there are, you know, informal groups out there. Part of what was going on when I started the support group for estranged adults who are considering or experiencing cutoff from a parent was that most of the research that I did indicated that there were lots and lots of communities for parents who have been cut off. And yet a lot of those virtual communities and even social support groups tended to be more echo chambers around the pain and not a lot of questioning about, you know, accountability, role development, and how to potentially foster change or initiate repair in their relationship with their children. So I saw a need with regards to working with adults who are deciding to potentially set boundaries with a parent around how do you deal with the ambivalence you're feeling and how to normalize issues like shame and dealing with stigma and the fact that this is just not an issue that's been talked about. And then getting clear on what you want, what you hope for. Because, you know, once estrangement's on the table, it typically means that a relationship has been strained so far that there isn't an assumption that the other person that your feelings or experience matters to the other person. And then you're sort of deciding, am I willing to live without them anymore? And that's a pretty extreme place to get to. And yet when I offered it, people came.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break and then we're going to start hearing what our listeners have to say about this. Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money, has invited us all into a conversation she's been leading with her listeners about estrangement. And for the rest of this hour, we are going to have that conversation with you. We'll take your calls and we'll see what kind of solutions we can come up with after a break.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright, and this week, Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money, has invited us into a conversation she's been having with listeners over on her podcast. We're talking about estrangement. Or put another way, can't we all just get along? And what happens when the answer is absolutely not? Anna and I are joined by Rebecca Martinez Fitzgerald, a therapist in Durham, North Carolina. And let's start hearing from you. Let's go to Meg in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Meg, welcome to the show.
Hi. So this is very interesting timing. I actually live in Idaho, and I'm just visiting back here in Sioux Falls with my father. And I'm currently being estranged from and with my mother and my sister. So back visiting my father, but not my mother, really.
And what is the source of your estrangement?
So my father's had some strokes, and he's in an assisted living. My mom chose to stay in their home, supported her on that. But recently she took a boyfriend and moved him into her home, my father's home. So this is a man who has his clothes in my dad's closet, his car in my dad's garage, his sleeping in my dad's bed. So morally, ethically, that's hard for me, but it's a gray area because of my dad's dementia. Mm. However, this man also told my mom when he started pursuing her that he wouldn't move to be with her unless he lived in the house. He's had some bad investments, and so he couldn't afford his own apartment. So I'm really concerned about my dad's estate. I've told my mom if she wants to divorce dad and do whatever she wants with her half of the money, I'd be fully supportive of her. But that doesn't seem to be something she wants to do.
Oh, Meg, that sounds really painful and difficult. I just have a question as far as talking with your mother or your sibling that you mentioned there. What's that been like when you've said, oh, I have some real difficulties ethically and morally with this? Is that a conversation that you feel like you've been able to have honestly and candidly with one another?
No, not easily at all. That's not the history of our communication style. My sister, when he first moved in, I was very angry. And my conversation with her, she just said, we're on different pages, so I won't talk to you about him at all. And that led to just a discontinuation. We tried, and she made some rules about what I could say or how, and I didn't I just said I'm not willing to have that sort of relationship. My mom and I have become very superficial, talk about movies, books, TV, food. But he also has tried to ingratiate himself into my family. And my dad's siblings have also separated and taken a step back from my mom. So there's been a dissolution of our grander family. And texts he's sent out have been very hurtful, trying to make it feel like he's part of our family. I've told my mom I have a boundary that he shouldn't be texting me, but he has still done that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, for sharing that story, Meg. And let's take a few and then have Rebecca respond to some of them. Let's go to Mina in Pittsburgh. Mina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I'm calling regarding actually abortion and estrangement from my partner of 10 years. Let's see. So I've been an ardent abortion rights advocate, reproductive rights advocate my whole life. I've been going to marches and being involved in the effort to keep reproductive rights available to everyone for as long as I can remember. I've been with my partner for 10 years. We had an abortion within the first year. And then, so this is Pennsylvania, where the stakes were high in the last election. And I asked him to vote. He's a non-voter. And he didn't. And I found that out around the election. And our relationship has just crumbled since then. And I'm actually planning on breaking up with him next week.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I can't get over it. I can't get over that he didn't fight for the same, that he doesn't have the same values with respect to people's rights and the right that he enjoyed. We, neither of us ever wanted children. So I don't want to say that he enjoyed the right, but we both benefited from it being available to us. Mm-hmm. And yet he didn't fight for it when the stakes were really high.
What do you think is like really at the core of it for you when you say that you've hit a values conflict that makes this relationship now impossible? What is it you think that really is at the core of that?
At the core of it for me is a matter of equity, that I think that it's that we're not seeing the fact that a partnership that involves the possibility of pregnancy and burdens of all sorts should be shared. Mm-hmm. And that part of the burden that we have in society is fighting for other people. And he did not fight for me.
Yeah, if I may, Mina, that's what I hear. I hear also the sense of betrayal that you asked him to vote, that it was important to you, and then he didn't, you found out later.
And that's conflicting too, because I don't want to influence anybody's vote. That doesn't feel like a good thing to do, which is why I've been struggling with this for now months.
Rebecca, what would you say to Mina in a situation like this?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of context that I think would be helpful to understand. I certainly hear that she's very hurt and surprised. And I think Anna hit the nail on the head when she suggested the word betrayal. It definitely seems like there was a rupture point when Bina's partner didn't end up voting. And then it sounds like the two of them have not been connecting in their conversations about what that decision meant to them. And whether it's about the choice not to vote or the quality of their connection since he made that decision, it seems like she's feeling really, really hurt. And with Bina and Meg both, it seems as though people have set a boundary but not been willing to engage further to strengthen the relationship after that point. And it makes sense to want your pain to be seen and validated. But I just want to caution folks, you may decide that your relationship is incompatible or there are factors about the two of you that are incompatible and that may be grounds enough to end it. But it hurts to cut off a relationship like this too. So I would just ask folks, is this the pain that you're willing to live with after you end this relationship? I also want to name for Meg too, that you lose influence when you step away from a relationship. It sounds like she really wants her mom to hear her, her mom's boyfriend to validate her boundaries, the family to rally around her. But estrangement doesn't get you more influence. In fact, it involves losing it.
Let's go to Jeff in Brooklyn. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Okay, so I live in New York, but I'm originally from a city in the Midwest. And I left the Midwest in my 20s, and I haven't moved back since. So, but every time I go back to visit, my siblings, two adult siblings, they're younger than I am, but they're adults. I'm middle age at this point. Things devolve into homophobic. I'm also a gay man. I should have said that. Things always to the point now where I dread going back, devolve into homophobic name calling and threats of violence. And I go back primarily to visit my mother. She's still alive, thank God. But she doesn't approve, but she's not, there's not the name calling from her and comments, which I probably couldn't repeat, that my siblings make about, you know, you engage in such and such sexual acts, you're disgusting, you're nasty, we should do this, to, you know, X, Y, and Z to you, that kind of thing. So I've considered severing ties or just going back at all at this point. It's dreadful even to think about going, because I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but you know, I want to visit my mother, but I also feel bad. You know, it took a lot of years to work through the internalization of the homophobia, and as I said, at this point I'm middle age. And still putting, you know, I'm not a teenager or, you know, some kid. I'm a middle-aged man still having to deal with threats of violence and name-calling from my own family members.
Jeff, let me jump in so I can get Rebecca to respond. Because I've heard this kind of story over and over and over again. You know, I'm a gay man. I know a lot of people with this kind of relationship with their family. Rebecca, I know you work a lot with LGBT people. What does Jeff's story make you think about?
Oh, it's bringing up a whole lot of compassion, Jeff. It really sounds like you're hurting. And I'm hearing you putting yourself out there, making yourself very vulnerable to go back to your hometown every time you do see your mother, only to have the fears and the things that you're trying to avoid being thrown in your face. Nobody should have to subject themselves to threats, verbal abuse, degradation. You deserve to be treated with dignity and respect in all relationships. And it is fully appropriate for you to set boundaries with your siblings around what you will stand for. And yet you kind of have to make a judgment call over what kind of effort you're willing to put into your connection with your mother. It's got to be so painful to travel all that way and to feel pressure to hide an enormous part of your identity. Now, if that's a relationship that's very important to you, you might consider whether you're going to tolerate seeing your siblings when you're visiting your mom. And if your mom will support your boundaries around keeping distance from them or, you know, deciding what you're going to do if they do bring up the name calling when they're around, maybe it means stepping away. Maybe it means saying, I'm not going to come back again if you do this to me. You might want to talk that through with your mother, or you might decide that the visits are too painful. That's definitely something to think through. And yet I can tell that this relationship with your mom's important to you, and I would hate to see you cut it off before you're ready.
Jeff, I just thank you for sharing that. I know it's hard and it's going to stay hard. so I hope others listening to it can get something out of that as well. Let's go to George, also here in Manhattan. George, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And what are you dealing with in terms of estrangement in a relationship?
Well, I'm in an interesting little scenario where I'm trying to broker or help to not have an estrangement happen between my mother and my sister. Mm. And both sides are a little stubborn and a little silly. And my sister is taking the approach that estrangement is, you know, the only way right now. And doesn't seem to me to be like a good long-term solution. So looking for any advice you guys might have on how to, you know, play a middleman here and help everybody out.
Unless that's
too naive.
What is, to the degree that you're willing to share, what is the source of this ongoing estrangement? Before we ask Rebecca to chime in with what people do in these broker situations in general.
Sure. So my mother is a classic, not.
Oh, I think we lost George for a moment there. So Rebecca, will you let us know for people who are just sort of in that broker situation, right? Like where they're trying to say, hey, you know, I can get in the middle here. I can figure this out. My family can heal whatever the divide is. Is that something you hear a lot? And, you know, is it a good idea?
Well, again, not having a lot of the specifics, I want to say I bristled a little bit when I heard him say that his mom and sister were being a little silly, because what I'm hearing is that the estrangement is really uncomfortable for him, which makes a lot of sense. And yet, because he wants to help them broker a repair, reconnect their relationship, he is unlikely to be successful if he is adding to the invalidation of the members of his family. In any parent-child relationship, there's an inherent power dynamic. So I would question, you know, whether it might be useful sending them to a family therapist to examine whether the mother wants to be right or does she want to be close? Can she tap into her desire to give care and to hear her daughter's concerns? Can the daughter take that in? Is that a new foundation that can be set? Because until that happens, it's unlikely that a solid repair is going to be put in place. Yeah.
This isn't exactly what George was talking about, but I know, in Anna's series, in Death, Sex, and Money, one of the things that really stood out to me was this, were people who were in the process of estranging, that there's this spectrum of behavior that falls underneath this thing we're calling estrangement. And that seemed like a particularly confusing place to be. And I just wonder how often that comes up and what you say to folks in those situations.
It comes up all the time. It comes up even in people who aren't intending to create like intense distance with a parent. It comes up after hurt feelings at Thanksgiving. And yet the thing about estrangement, you know, for what little research exists, it typically tends to be a temporary process and is often cyclical. Very often when a relationship is strained so consistently and yet somebody is not willing to, or when the parties involved are not willing to do a solid, intense repair or end it altogether, what happens is it starts to get distant and then a reconnection happens and then it gets distant again. But very rarely does somebody cut off a relationship and have it end, because very often, especially in these attachment relationships, it's just so painful to live with that decision forever.
Let's go to Parker in Manchester, New Hampshire. Parker, welcome to the show.
Well, as I had explained to the call screener, I lost my partner, and she was my dearest love, my best friend, my lover for almost 35 years. And I lost her October 2021. And part of her life for all that, let me explain that our relationship started out improperly. I was married. She was recently divorced. It was irresponsible, but it was also irreplaceable for both of us. We were madly in love from the beginning. And she had a core group of friends that were, she called them her chosen sisters. And they were just like family to her. They loved her. She loved them. She shared an awful lot with them. And for all those years, I felt that they were, at the very least, my friends, but mostly they were my friends because they cared for Lisa so much. And I felt that it was reciprocal, that I was their friend because I cared for their friend, Lisa, as dearly as I did. The last 3 years of Lisa's life, I was her constant caregiver. Lisa died from a combination of lymphoma as well as dementia. And when she died, it was made very clear to me shortly afterwards that they really didn't care to have anything to do with me. And to the point where this past October, 2022, we finally had Lisa's memorial service. And I delivered the eulogy. And in the eulogy, I included a lot about this core group of friends she had that she called her chosen sisters. And not one of them approached me during that memorial service and had anything to say to me.
Oh,
and I feel very much estranged from them. They are my biggest and maybe my only connection to Lisa other than my own memories.
Parker, I hear the how painful that's been for you. First, I want to say I'm sorry for the loss of your partner. I'm curious, have you, since that memorial service, have you reached out to any of these women and said, can we get a cup of tea? And then what do you think would happen if you did?
I don't know what would happen if I did. I think, I don't know. I mean, they've, one of them made it clear she didn't want to, really want anything to do with me. Didn't want to talk to me. Is the way I think she put it. And I don't really understand why. There was a significant distancing from me with Lisa's family, her brother and her sister, for years, I think going back to the fact that, you know, I was married and having an affair with their sister. And there was a mistrust, I think, that lingered. And it almost feels like the core group of friends has chosen to step into the family's camp instead of mine.
Thank you, Parker. Rebecca, do you have anything that you would add to Parker's story?
I'm heartbroken that there was such a lack of support after Lisa's death. I mean, it makes sense to honor the boundary set by the one person who said they didn't want to connect. And from Lisa's family, that said, I think Anna's onto something when she suggests you reach out maybe to one of the friends who didn't explicitly name why she was seeking distance. I want to say grief and loss can be really uncomfortable for a lot of people, and it can make shifting relationships really difficult to navigate. So if these are relationships that you'd still like to hold on to and they haven't told you that they absolutely do not want you in their lives, it might be worth it to check in with them and see what they think and whether they're willing to stay in touch. It would also be a good idea, if you haven't already, to seek somebody to give you some support, either bereavement counseling or a loss support group, because you really deserve connection in this time.
I hope that's helpful, Parker. And again, we're just sorry for your loss. And I have to say, boy, that there's some really, everyone is really bringing the truth to this conversation. So I really appreciate it, listeners. You guys are really chiming in with some tough stories. Let's hear from Cindy in Twin Cities. Cindy, welcome to the show.
Good evening. I will try to keep it short because I'm looking at the clock.
Cindy, don't you worry about that. That's my problem.
No, I get it. One of my stepfathers was a broadcaster. I get it.
Excellent.
So 2016 election, I voted as I had in 2012, which means I wrote a candidate in. I didn't like anybody on that ticket. My two bestest friends knew that. One of these friends I'd known since college, 25 years, just my bestest friend. I met one of her friends almost 15 years prior, and the three of us, I mean, we had a years-long group text. Okay, so these are the girls that got me through my divorce. I mean, just best friends, right? they knew I wasn't going to vote how they voted. I also didn't vote for the other guy, which I got into a fight with my dad about that. But that's a conversation for another time. They flipped out. One of them sent her husband to verbally attack me online. There has never been an apology. The one friend that I'd known for about 15 years, she's never made an attempt to reach back out. The other friend sent a text. At the time, I was living in Florida, sent a text while I was in the middle of a hurricane to say, hey, how are you doing? Are you okay? I hear there's a hurricane. Okay, yeah, guess what? Priorities, you're not on it right now.
You know, Cindy, what I want to tell you is what you're describing, these texts and the social media comments and how they are exploding long-term relationships with electronic communication. That's something we heard a lot about in our series on estrangement. So it might not be a comfort, but this is not an uncommon experience from what we heard from listeners. And again, just like I said to Parker, the thing that I always wonder is what would happen if you made call? Or had some in-person conversation and to see if that would shift some of the dynamics.
And Cindy will understand that we are tight on time, so I'm going to go straight to Rebecca. Just quickly, in the few seconds we have here, politics getting in the way of people's relationships. What are your parting thoughts on that?
Politics and religion and death and sex and money, they all make us feel super reactive. Emotions run high, and yet those high intense emotions don't build relationships or strengthen relationships. It's really important to slow things down and see if there's any room for connection personally or over a phone call or something that is definitely more personal and validating than social media. If this relationship's important to you, see if they'll meet you on your level and for in person.
That was therapist Rebecca Martinez Fitzgerald, who practices in Durham, North Carolina. Rebecca has a special focus in her practice for people experiencing estrangement. And Kai Wright was hosting alongside me. Kai hosts Notes from America every week. You can hear the live broadcast on Sundays on public radio stations across the country. And check them out wherever you get podcasts or on WNYC's YouTube channel to follow what they make week in and week out. There's a link to that in our show notes. It is a really fantastic show. Along with Kai, the Notes from America team includes Regina Dahir, Karen Frillman, Kusha Navadar, Rahima Nassa, and Jared Paul. Matthew Mirando was at the board during the live show. Lindsay Foster Thomas is a vice president at WNYC Studios, which is the home of both Notes from America and Death, Sex, and Money. Zoe Azoulay produced this for Death, Sex, and Money, and the rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Afi Yellowduke, and Andrew Dunn. Baze Hohen is our intern. If you didn't catch our three-part series on estrangement that came out at the end of last year, you can find it at deathsexmoney.org/estrangement. There's a link to that series page in our show notes. Then we also link to a list of resources that you helped us generate. Those of you who've experienced estrangement shared what's been helpful to you. Again, thank you for joining in this conversation with us. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.